We're talking about college debt and middle-class families here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Children are relying on their parents for far longer than they did in previous generations, and a great deal has changed in the cost of college. From the late 80s to the present, tuition has increased at a rate four times that of inflation. Back then, more than half of 20-somethings in our country were financially independent, and that's not a reality today. Some economists fear there's a student debt bubble that could burst. What is your story about college debt? What do you think needs to change? And what do you think about parents who took advantage of a loophole to secure financial aid? 800-642-1234 to join in through the hour. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is a higher education policy and sociology professor at Temple University. She founded the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice in Philadelphia, and she wrote a book called Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. Sarah, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
So regarding this recent ProPublica investigation, it found a number of suburban Chicago families were giving up custody of their kids so they could get need-based financial aid that they wouldn't otherwise get, and that this practice could be happening around the country sporadically. As you watch higher education policy, does this surprise you?
Well, I mean, first, the likelihood that this is happening in a large number of places or being done by a large number of families is extremely unlikely. The rate of cheating in federal financial aid programs is very, very, very low, lower than many other social programs. And I'm certainly not going to condone what these parents did, but what they really did was highlight a very broken system that does a terrible job of assessing families' actual need for support when it comes to financing college. And so that's the real issue. The fact that we've had the same broken financial aid system for 50 years that really isn't getting the job done.
And we're going to look at the financial aid system and how that system works, the inner workings of it. But the families involved in these guardianship cases, they weren't poor. They were lawyers and physicians and an assistant school superintendent. Do you see this move as opportunistic, or has college really become that unaffordable?
You know, the truth is, when you look at the data, especially over the last 20 years, college actually has become that unaffordable. I think that the system was built under the assumption that only about one in four people would need financial assistance in order to go to college. I'd argue that if you really took a hard look at Americans' finances today, three in four people need that help, and that the need for that help is stretching way up into what you might call the upper middle class. Now, I'm not saying that there weren't some folks here who genuinely could pay and decided not to. However, they're fleetingly rare at this moment. Instead, we find people who, yes, they might be doctors or lawyers, but they have $100,000 or more of their own debt. They have credit card debt. They have a house. We can argue that they should give up those things in order to send their child to college, but we can't pretend like that's going to be easy. And I suspect those are the calculations that these folks were doing.
We're talking with Sarah Goldrick-Rabb. She's a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University. You can join in through the hour at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about the ability for your family to afford college? How are you looking at the price tag? What calculations are you doing now? Join in with your story. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah, how is financial aid currently calculated? What is that? What goes into that expected family contribution?
Well, I suspect that many of your listeners have experience with this small American bureaucratic tragedy that we call the FAFSA. And as they go through that form and they complete it, they give up a bunch of personal information about themselves. It includes things like the number of people in the family, the number of those people attending college, the family's income, the family's assets, and all of that information is used in a formula that will never be disclosed. And it's used to complete and construct what we call, in highly paternalistic terms, the expected family contribution. Now, I want you to note what I didn't say the form asks about. The form does not ask about your debt of any kind. The form does not ask about if you are supporting your elderly parents, for example. The form neglects whether or not you have good or bad credit. It has a number of pieces missing that shape your overall financial picture. So the expected family contribution, which says to a student, hey, your parents, according to the federal government, can and should do this for you, frankly, it's often mistaken.
And this is the free application for federal student aid, FAFSA. So it's not giving the entire picture, but it's still looking at the taxes you pay and a lot of other calculations like your income. Why isn't that enough?
It isn't enough because I think as anybody who tries to get by day to day knows, you know, there's a lot more that goes into one's financial health. And there have been numerous studies that have been done over the last decade or so on the broader financial health of Americans that suggest that many of us are in a lot of trouble. There are even studies that suggest that enormous numbers of people could not bear a surprise of even, say, $300 or $400 or $500. So, you know, it's because of the complexity of our lives. It's because of the number of people that we support in formal and informal ways. And it's because of the incredible amount of debt that so many people have taken on that things like income just don't cut it.
Let's bring in Marcus now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi. What's your situation?
So I own my own business. I have a double major from UW-Milwaukee with its political science and history. I currently still owe $60,000 on FAFSA student loans, and I have a 16-year-old that's looking at trying to narrow it down to what state college he's going to be going to in 2 years, and I have no idea where to even begin.
Marcus, thank you for your story. Sarah, this is probably something you have heard before.
Absolutely, and I'm so sorry that he's in that situation because, you know, the first thing that you can hear from him is that his daughter is focused on going to a public institution in the state. It isn't as if he said, my daughter wants to go to Princeton and now I have to figure out how to pay for that. He's saying, I'm supposed to choose a reasonable option within the state. And yet, let's be honest, he owns his own business. He's done fairly well, most likely. He's probably not going to qualify for most of the need, quote unquote, need-based financial aid out there. It sounds like he's part of the missing middle class in the financial aid system that's told that they're too rich to get things like the Pell Grant, but they're too poor to be able to afford college without it. And it's going to be a tough road.
On this road to understanding what families need to be able to afford college, what should we be asking? How do you account for the situation middle-class families are in?
Well, I mean, look, first of all, the prices have been going up for college for decades. So that's not a new story. What's new here is that families are not doing as well as they used to. And it's creating a wider and wider gap between what they can afford to pay and what college costs. It's time to ask the question, do we have the federal system of financial aid that we need and deserve? And if we don't, are we willing to vote to change it?
Talking with Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, she is a higher education policy and sociology professor at Temple University. How important is financial aid to your child's college? How different is the bottom line cost compared to a generation ago? Students, are you struggling to pay back loans? Did you read the fine print? Join in with your story, your questions about college costs. It's 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about student loan debt in our country, how it's transforming middle-class families. A recent investigation by ProPublica in Illinois found that some parents had been giving up custody of their college-bound students to get financial aid. Over the past several decades, college tuition has increased at a rate 8 times that of household income. You look to Capitol Hill, and Democratic lawmakers have called for increasingly aggressive government solutions for erasing existing student debt. So what do you think is the solution to this? What is your story about student loans? What does your repayment plan look like? We're at 800-642-1234 throughout the hour. You can share your story. We're with Sarah Goldrick-Rabb. She's a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University, and she founded the Hope Center for College Community and Justice in Philadelphia. Well, Sarah, take us back to the 1980s when more than half of Americans in their 20s were financially independent, and compare what we see today over several decades, how students are reliant on their parents.
Well, a number of different things have happened over those last many decades, and a lot of them began, frankly, with a set of policy decisions. It took place in the early 1980s, many of them under the leadership of President Ronald Reagan and his budget director, David Stockman. David Stockman's theory of what people needed in their life was essentially this: if you want a higher education, it's your responsibility to pay for it, period. And the resulting stream of policies that came from that idea really took away a lot of the grant support that had been put in place. It greatly diminished the ability of people to pay for college without having to turn to loans. And at the same time, they were dismantling a set of other supports that helped families. So, for example, I think Wisconsin knows very well that the cash assistance program to poor families was radically changed, both at the state and federal levels over the ensuing 15 years. The result is not only that many young people are now supporting their are now on their own and their parents are having to help them, but quite frankly, many young people are actually helping keep their parents afloat as well. And that's another dynamic of paying for college we do not talk enough about. It is not only the case that young people are living at home because their parents are paying for them, but rather that they're living at home because paying bills together as a family helps keep the family financially afloat.
Let's bring in Owen now in De Pere. Owen, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
A thought might be to open the financial aid to the general market and add competition to the mix. It appears we now have basically a monopoly through the federal government. And as I understand it originally was intended to provide some income to pay for some of the Medicare costs from 2010 going forward, and that just hasn't seemed to work very well. But maybe the market can aid in that issue by giving people a number of choices for aid with different conditions.
So Owen is looking to open up, Sarah, beyond the federal government, where aid really comes from.
You know, I'm a little confused by that, because the truth is that there are a large number of different sources of both grants and loans available, some of which come from the federal government, but the private sector actually offers a wide variety of them. In fact, as you noted, until 2010, so for, you know, about 40 years, private banks originated student loans, and the terms were not good. So, you know, yes, the federal government took over in 2010 in terms of originating student loans, but it did so to great benefit of American taxpayers, most notably saving the taxpayers an enormous amount of money that was being paid out to private banks, and also creating new assurances such as income-driven repayment plans that are actually protecting borrowers right now. The private sector has predominantly offered one new form of financial aid in the last few years. It's called income share agreements, and many compare it to a form of indentured servitude.
When you talk about 10 years ago, we think of the Great Recession. What did the Great Recession do, and how did it impact the student debt crisis we see today?
Well, it made things worse in at least three different ways. The first is that it profoundly destabilized families. So the amount of wealth held by people in this country went down quite a bit since the Great Recession, and particularly for African-American families who saw their wealth virtually decimated. Secondly, it changed the labor market. So it is not the same situation today to try to get a job as it was as a college student in the 80s. You have a lot more competition for those part-time jobs in particular,
and employers don't offer the pay that they used to, including the fact that the minimum wage has declined. And, you know, the other piece is that states profoundly disinvested in financial aid. And what that means is they did not increase the aid at the corresponding way that the prices were going up. And they also helped drive up prices in public colleges and universities by refusing to put in as much money. They've essentially passed the buck on to the taxpayer at a time when taxpayers can afford less than ever.
We're talking with Sarah Goldrick-Rabb. She's a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University. She's also the author of Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. We're looking at all facets of the student aid crisis and the loans that have come through it. You can join in with your plan for affording college, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Susan now in Elmina. Hi, Susan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. I just wanted to comment that back when I went to school back in the late 80s, early 90s, the UW system, the state was paying in about 40% of our tuition costs to keep it more affordable. And now they're down to 25% as a state paying in tuition. I have a son that's starting as a freshman, and our wages, I'm making probably about the same that my father was making back in the days. Now that, and this is 25 years, 30 years later. So we're bringing in, the wage difference hasn't changed. Now I do work in the public sector, but the wages haven't kept up with the costs that have increased over time with inflation and then the lack of investment as a state. So we are suffering as middle-class families. We're really not, we're hardly keeping up with being middle-class any longer. So it's really a struggle for us.
And as you look at this struggle, Susan, may I ask, how are you approaching college for this next generation? What are your thoughts?
Well, we are taking a loan. My son's taking a loan, and we have good credit. We're paying prime, which is 5.5%. He will almost pay, when he gets out of college, he'll pay double almost the amount that he's taking out for college, which to me is a sad state of affairs when we turn around and give businesses and corporations, you know, breaks at 3 or 2 or 3% interest rates, and then we're going to charge students double or triple that. I think it's sad for our students coming out what they'll be saddled with. So we'll help our son along and then our daughter after that as much as we can. But I think it's really a challenge to make it all work right now and be able to retire someday.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, what do you hear in Susan's story?
Well, I mean, we know that this is the national story right now. There's a terrific new book out about exactly this challenge of parenting in the middle class at this moment called Indebted. And it was just covered in the New York Times. I recommend it. You know, you're not alone. You did nothing wrong, but you're raising a child in the midst of a breakdown in public policy. And it's impossible for a middle-class family right now to save their way out of this. This isn't a mark of bad parenting. It doesn't mean you didn't put enough into the 529. It means, frankly, that if we think college costs too much, we have to vote to change this. Now, you know, I think that the taking of the loan is, you know, it obviously sounds suboptimal, but it's the only choice that you have. And your point about corporations is well taken, because when we invest in students' education, at the very least, we all get a very large payoff. The rate of return on an investment in education exceeds almost everything else. So it really is a darn shame. As my grandfather would put it, we're eating our seed corn.
Sarah, what do you make of prime rate and the interest rate being paid on these student loans?
So we're at an interesting moment where the rates sometimes offered by the federal government on their loans are occasionally higher, sometimes lower, but occasionally higher than those offered in the private market. And some people say, well, that means that the federal government is profiting. You know, it's really not the case. And it's because what has happened is that because the federal government is originating the loans, we do have to be sure that we can cover the cost if they're not repaid. Remember, people are not doing credit checks when they take out these loans. So there is a real risk that they're not repaid. On the other hand, there's a risk to not making these loans, because people who are poor will stay poor. People who are falling from the middle class will continue to fall without access to education. So the interest rate is designed to, number one, cover that risk. Number two, we need to know that people who take loans from the federal government are covered by a set of protections they do not receive if they take private loans. And those protections are arguably the most valuable part of that loan. It means, for example, that if you make no money in a given year and you file your paperwork, you pay no money in that given year. It helps to prevent default.
And let's pause right there on default with Temple University sociologist and higher education policy professor Sarah Goldrick Rabb. You can join in with your story, 800-642-1234. Back to this conversation after a news update here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about student debt and what it's doing to the middle class. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The debt crisis has come to the forefront in the run-up to the 2020 presidential election as Democratic candidates propose their plans. Here are Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders in recent months.
We are going to roll back student loan debt for about 95% of students who have debt. And part two is to make sure that we never get in this mess again.
By taking this action, we not only provide immediate financial relief to 45 million Americans who have $1.6 trillion in debt, but we will be improving the entire economy.
Have you been comparing what presidential candidates propose on college tuition? Where do you see a solution to this? Do you think free college for all would work in our country? 800-642-1234. Temple University sociologist Sarah Goldrick Rabb stays with us. Sarah, one of the more active places that we're seeing talk about the student debt crisis right now is on this 2020 presidential campaign trail. And we just heard there Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. What do you see from the proposals coming out from these presidential hopefuls?
Well, the first thing that I see is a radical change from even the discussion 4 years ago. I think that many families should feel very glad that their concerns are being heard by so many folks and that they're coming up with proposals to address those issues. I really got to say it's a watershed moment in American higher ed that these things are being talked about. The specific nuances of one candidate's proposal versus another, frankly, is not nearly as important as the distinction between those who have plans and those who don't. We still have candidates out there who say the current system just needs a few tweaks. Maybe we need to simplify the FAFSA and move on. I don't think so. The fact is that there is a call to really overhaul things, and that I think we're facing a moment the way we did about 100 years ago when we asked ourselves the question, should we make public high school free? And so what they're really seeing in those proposals are efforts to do something big and bold.
Do you think that the student debt crisis will be a big enough issue in this election and influence candidates' chances at being the Democratic nominee? Will it sway people?
I mean, this is really the question, right? We know that at home over the dinner table, the question of college prices and correspondingly student debt is a major topic of conversation. Will people move that from lamenting and complaining at the dinner table into the voting booth and to make this a primary issue on which they cast the ballot? That's the question. If they do, we have a chance for the first time ever, I think, in the last 50 years, at really getting a very different situation for ourselves and for the future.
Let's bring in another call now. Chris joining us from Adams. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. I would like to thank you, Professor Goldrick Rabb, for your work. It's the politicians who voice the issues, but you guys do all of the legwork, and I really appreciate that you've been dealing with this for a long, long time. I have a rather amazing story. I am the first generation of working class families on both sides of my family. It was necessary for me to take out student loans. I excelled in college. I was offered a $40,000 doctoral fellowship, the premier fellowship in the School of Letters and Science at UWM. My last semester in school, I filed a sexual harassment complaint against a professor in the department I was in, and it turned into a huge fiasco in which the Labor Department ended up almost shutting down UWM because they refused to comply with the law. I was retaliated against. The fellowship was reneged, and the regents of the University of Wisconsin system took out a lien on my house for the student loan that UWM was administrating. They refused to take it off. I lost my home, and all of my stuff was stolen. The woman who facilitated this in the community is a benefactor to UWM, and in praise for her having gotten this, this goes full circle about how the wealthy get to manipulate the system. Her daughter got inappropriate and not stuff she worked for, accolades to put on her resume for graduate school, and it works. She's a professor of Yale at law at Yale University, and I'm homeless. So,
well, Chris, I want to step in there for Sarah. Is it possible, Sarah, to lose a home because of student loan debt?
Yes, it's entirely possible, and it's also possible for a school to make promises and provide support to a student when they're early on and to remove that support later on during college. In fact, one of the main reasons that people are so upset about the student loan debt that they've had to take is that it came as a surprise and it didn't feel like a choice. So we see all sorts of bait and switches where institutions will say it's going to be free, it's going to be, you know, at the initial piece, right? It's going to be, we're giving this $40,000 scholarship. You shouldn't need a $40,000 scholarship to go to a public institution because it shouldn't cost anywhere near that. And that, in fact, is the real crisis.
Does this happen to athletes as well who are on full ride scholarships? But what happens when they get injured?
It does. It does. And in fact, you know, my book, Paying the Price, for those who don't know, it's set in Wisconsin, and it was based on really painstaking work that a big team of us did over 6 years. And in there, I feature a man who, like so many other farm boys around Wisconsin, you know, grew up dreaming of being a football player. And he played for one of our schools for a while, and then he got injured. And yes, he lost his scholarship. He had to change schools, and he had to deal with an injury, and his life went sideways. But the other thing that people don't think about is that the NCAA rules for athletes mean that when they fall on hard times, let's say they don't have enough to eat or they don't have a safe place to sleep, it's actually illegal for people to step in and try to support them. So the only thing they're allowed to do is to take on more debt because nobody else can provide support.
When you talk about not having enough to eat, is food insecurity an issue for students on campuses today?
Yes, it is. And my team first uncovered, you know, it was something that students already knew about in fall of 2008 when we were doing research at UW-Milwaukee. Since then, we identified food insecurity on every single one of Wisconsin's 42 public two-year and four-year campuses. And since that time, we have identified it as existing on more than 350 other colleges and universities across the United States. The federal government has used our data and others to confirm that, in fact, this is a crisis facing students. And to bring it back to student debt, please note that the majority of student debt is taken so that students can afford to eat and survive during college. That's an intended use of student loans because it allows them to cover costs so that they can focus on school. Just like school children get a free lunch in the morning, a free breakfast and free lunch so that they can focus, that disappears for college students, and so they take on debt so they can afford it.
Let's bring in another call now. James is joining us from Green Bay. Hi, James.
Hello.
What is on your mind about student debt?
Well, it occurs to me that a lot of my friends have master's degrees in fields that just aren't hiring, and they're making tacos. I went to trade school for 3 months, and I'm pulling down 50 stacks a year, which isn't glorious, but it's not making tacos. And I'm just thinking that if these universities would advertise the job placement rates of each program, you'd get a lot less people enrolling in programs that aren't going to net them jobs, that have been proven not to net them jobs. Tech schools already advertise this with pride. Like NWTC, they'll say, you know, 99% of our graduates in the welding program got a job in the first year.
James, may I ask, what did you go to trade school for?
I am a CDL truck driver. I've actually been doing that for several years, and now I'm a truck driving teacher.
How is that going for you? Is it fulfilling?
Extremely.
Sarah, what do you make of community colleges, trade schools, and getting into the job market more quickly?
I mean, look, these are terrific schools, and I was so blessed to spend time on both the campuses of the UW colleges and the 16 Wisconsin Technical Colleges while I was in the state for 12 years. And, you know, the trades are a very, very good option. I want to be clear, they are one option. We don't want to become a society where people can only pursue career pathways based on their need for money. It would be a disaster. It would be a disaster for our democracy. No one would ever become a historian. No one would ever go into fields that have been very important. You know, transit and transportation and driving a truck is essential, but we need all kinds of different folks. There is an increasing amount of data out there actually on the job placement rates and the wages associated with programs. And yet we do still see people going into programs and areas like teaching that don't pay much. It's really hard to imagine a world where people looked at the payment associated with teaching and said, we're just not going into it. I know Wisconsin's seen a downturn in the availability of teachers in particular fields, and we know what that's going to do to our kids. So I think that we need to first correct the prices before we start driving people's choices based only on what the jobs will pay.
Do you think that governments should legislate in terms of prices? How much should government be involved in what the price tag is for public education, public higher ed?
Well, I do think that we need to correct some problems because right now the federal government actually funds an enormous amount of higher education and gets to say very little about prices. And particularly, it has very little control over some of the worst actors. So, you know, I don't know how many of your listeners realize that when they paid their taxes back in April, they funded places like the University of Phoenix to run commercials during the Super Bowl, recruiting people to its schools. The fact that the federal government spends tens of billions of dollars on institutions that literally set high prices based on the availability of financial aid and has not been able to stop them from doing that, that's a problem. We need a new system that holds them accountable for their prices. We also need a system at the federal level that says to states, if you want to receive federal state financial aid for your students, you cannot jack up the prices at your own state universities.
We've got to pause right there talking with Temple University's Sarah Goldrick-Rabb. We'll get back to this discussion in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the student loan crisis and how middle-class families are approaching college. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's been estimated that there's $1.6 trillion of outstanding student debt in our country. About 45 million Americans currently have student loans, and it's taking an especially hard toll on millennials. The Federal Reserve says over a third of borrowers are under 30. So what is your story and how you paid for college? Are you going through this now with financial aid forms and loan processing? What does it feel like to take out college loans? Do you worry about your pay schedule, how to pay them back? We're at 800-642-1234. Temple University sociologist Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is our guide. She founded the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice in Philadelphia. Let's go back to the phones now. Paul joining us from Heartland. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I'd just like to comment on something I heard the guest say earlier. I guess I disagree with her take on saying that it's important that we fund all the different types of degrees and whatnot. I think it's more important right now, especially with the amount of debt that we are focusing on funding degrees. You know, if college is an investment, we should focus on funding degrees that are going to eventually lead to a job that you can pay back your loans. Both my parents went to college at UW-Madison, and they paid loans for a lot of their lives. I did not go to college. Right now I work as a roofer. I'm a foreman, and I own my own home. I'm 32 years old, and I'm set financially right now. I think that, you know, I'm maybe a unique case, but at the same time, I don't think, you know, we're putting our money in the right place as far as education goes.
Paul, thank you for those comments. Sarah, what do you make of that?
Well, first, I'm delighted to hear that Paul is in a good place. And it is the case that at this moment in the American economy, about 1 in 5 good jobs is open to somebody like him who didn't go to education after high school. The problem is that the number of those good jobs that's going to be available to people in a few years is going to decrease fairly dramatically. And there are good reports out there that show this. So while he's set for now, his kids might not be if they make the same decisions. The other issue is, you know, I think he and I do have a philosophical difference. I think that it's important to right-size the prices to maximize people's choices in their lives. I think it would be a shame if in America, your ability to pursue a career that for the rest of your life was shaped by whether or not you were going to have to pay off a student loan. And as I said earlier, I think that we would have far fewer teachers and nurses and other public servants in this country if, in fact, that was the deciding factor.
Well, up to this point, Sarah, we've heard a lot of turmoil over access to higher ed, but you're part of the academy, right? You're inside higher ed. What is going right with how we deliver college education in America?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting thing being inside. And I actually have to say for your listeners, I think if they know me, they know that I'm actually trying really hard to fix it from the inside. And it helps me to see things like how universities do their budgets because I have more access from the inside. But I do also have a window onto what is working. And I think the good news is this. You know, first, we are seeing a sea change in institutions, not the most selective, okay, not those that reject more people than they admit, but in among the community colleges and the state regional universities, we're seeing growing recognition that college affordability comes before anything else, and that if we don't help ensure that students have their basic needs met, and we don't lower the price of books, and we don't offer affordable transportation, they cannot get degrees. And there has been a movement of schools that are radically changing practice to try to make things more affordable. The other thing that's positive is that students continue to come and find value in their education. They wish they didn't have to pay so much for it, but the mere fact that we have homeless college students who are willing to fight day in and day out for their education is a testament to the fact that they're finding something of value in those classrooms. If we were offering something that wasn't worthwhile, they would drop out. And it's really that simple.
Let's bring in another call, Isaiah in Madison with thoughts on this. Hi, Isaiah.
Hi. Hi. Yeah, I got a BFA from UW-Milwaukee in arts and technology. And this was probably 6-7 years ago that I graduated. And currently I'm working as a plumber. I'm an apprentice plumber. And I guess my experience with college wasn't quite on par with what they sell you when you go to school. I graduated. I had a whole bunch of debt. I mean, I remember going to school and not having a ton of money when I had to go to school. And my parents are both working class. I'm a first-generation college graduate. And when I got done with school, I have all this debt. It was about $40,000 or so worth of debt. By the time I get done paying it off, at the lowest rate I could pay it off, it'd be like $100,000. And at some point I decided I have to get a better job. I got to do something else that I can make more money. Obviously the career choice that I went to college for wasn't on par with living the lifestyle I wanted, but also making as much money to pay off the debt and be able to pay for a house and a car and not have to worry about owing money all the time.
You had intentions of becoming a graphic designer. You're a plumber now. In this situation, I mean, graphic design and plumbing, very, very different. What do you feel inside about fulfillment and what the choices you ended up making?
Well, I feel pretty good because my mechanical ability was always pretty high. So doing something like plumbing always kind of came easy. It comes easy to me. Graphic design wasn't terribly hard either. So I guess maybe I'm lucky in that aspect. But, you know, people say that sometimes and you're like, there's no shame in what I do now. I'm proud of what I do. I like it. I enjoy it. It's hard work. There are days where I'd much rather be sitting in an office, but it's more, it has more to do with the expectation of when I graduated from college that I was going to be able to secure this at least decent earning position. And it just really didn't materialize. It took me 4 years or so of working as a graphic designer after I was done with school before I switched trades, because at some point it just dawned on me I wasn't going to make the money I needed to live the lifestyle I wanted.
Isaiah, thanks for your story. Sarah, do we see those switches going on in our society right now?
Yeah, we absolutely do. And increasingly, you know, this is the story of so many people. They cannot expect to have a single career or one job. You know, a lot of what arguably higher education is preparing people for, though, is the ability to make those switches and the knowledge and the resilience to be able to navigate them. Now, I am not saying that what he went through is easy, and I'm not saying the fact that he went to college made that possible. I am saying that there's really good evidence that with a college degree, you're much better able to navigate the so-called storm that is happening in today's labor market. And what we worry about is when people don't even have that sort of protection. But I also very much hear him that he did not get from college what he expected. And I do believe strongly that we need to do a much better job of talking to people about the real price of college so that they are genuinely prepared.
Other programs out there on the table where students, it's contingent that they work in a specific area in order to get money. Right now, the state legislature in Wisconsin would give up to $30,000 in higher ed debt for college graduates who commit to farming, for instance. We see that in, you know, rural areas and physicians. What do you think of programs like that?
Well, so we have a federal program that's not dissimilar to that. I mean, the farming one sounds great. There's something called public service loan forgiveness, which essentially says, you know, that if you go into public service and there's a number of different kinds of programs that qualify, your loans can be forgiven. But unfortunately, the current administration in Washington is essentially walking back that promise to people. And even folks who for the last 10 years have graduated from college, gone off to work in that public service field, done everything right, these people are now eligible to have their loans forgiven. They're filing applications, and about 99% of them are being denied. And so this idea that we're even refusing as a country to live up to our promises that we've made folks and that they've made decisions based on, I mean, that's really unconscionable.
Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me today. I appreciate it.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University. She founded the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice in Philadelphia, author of Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.